Welcome to the Merrill Hodge Find a Way podcast. Today we're going to talk about an article that came out just a couple of days ago about Todd Ewan, a hockey player who is well documented, committed suicide, was going through depression. His title or nickname in hockey was the Enforcer. He had a lot of concussions, a lot of fights. That's why he got the nickname the Enforcer, how many minutes in the penalty box. And he was going through depression, and this narrative of CTE, it was well documented, just really drove him over the edge. When he committed suicide, his brain was sent to Lilly Hazzarotti. Lilly Hazzarotti up in Toronto, Canada, is one of the great minds on this planet. Is as well educated and researched and studied and experienced as anybody that I have ever met or talked to, because she went from pediatrics to adolescence. She's really done it all. When she went and looked at Todd Ewan's brain, she did actually, because of CT being so misunderstood and still in the observation state and so little known about it, she does what every good neuropathologist would do with integrity and no agenda, and just trying to find answers for our family that wanted some answers. She sends out to 5 neuropathologists. All of them do their own scans, stains, process. They all, so 6 of them, find no CTE in Todd Ewan. When they presented that to the family, Kelly Ewan, the widow, was not happy about that. And listen, I understand that. I lost my mom at a young age, so I understand the sting of death. I remember wanting to, blame things, and I wanted to find out answers. And ultimately, here's what I was trying to find out. I just wanted to come back. That's what I wanted. And the grieving process, there's no time limit on it. It's different for everybody. But I understand that. I identify with that. I sympathize with that. So that leads me to really the book, Brainwashed. The book I wrote, I actually bring 2 other cases into the book that were very similar, where neuropathologists outside Boston University look at the brain, don't find CT. Well, those brains end up going to BU somehow, some way. And what happens? Yep. They find CTE. Ann McKeegis finds CTE. So in the book, which went to print, over a couple months ago, I said, this brain's going to end up getting to BU. And they are going to end up finding CTE. So you got to pick up the book just for that perspective, because it's exactly what happened. And what is mind-boggling about that is, looking at the media to this point, is how now 6 other separate, independent neuropathologists who have no agenda whatsoever other than to do their job with integrity and character don't find CTE. And it's found at Boston University by Ann McKee. And what does she do to back that she has found it? She sends what she sees, her scans and her stains, to somebody in Jacksonville to confirm it. They don't do their separate study. They just confirm, yeah, that's what it is, Ann. All right. Well, that is why we've decided to do this podcast, to really explain to you really what the proper procedures are in science. One of the really brilliant minds I used in my book, too, to help me with all of this information, to make it understandable to people what the facts are, Rudy Castellani from WVU, the professor and vice chair of pathology research and section chief of neuropathology. We've had him join us to get his, his really vision and wisdom and experience with this disease. So we're glad that he's put a little bit of time aside to join us. So, Doctor, welcome to the Merrill Hodge Find a Way podcast. We're glad you could join us. And the podcast we're talking about today is the Todd Ewan case. And yeah, There's a bunch of things in it that I'm just going to, is absolutely corrupt. I mean, it's corrupt. Right. It's abuse of science. It's a misuse in grotesque manners, what Boston University has done. But this case, to me, is going to crystallize everything and what they've been doing in a rotten way. We kind of set it up before you came in, the case, so people are aware of the case. So I'm really going to just turn over to Dr. Cummings and let you guys really talk about what are the proper steps of science, the things that are not being done correctly, and there's things that people need to know about and be aware of when they read these particular articles in the paper. So we appreciate you joining us, and Dr. Cummings, I'll let you two brain trusts go at it.
Well, you just asked my question, brother. That was my question for Rudy. One of the things that strikes me reading the media stuff on this is the fact that Dr. Hazzarotti sent samples out to 5 other neuropathologists who did their own studies. So there's 6 neuropathologists in total who've looked at this and found no CTE.
Right,
and
right.
Can you explain to people what that process entails so they have an idea of what it means when you send tissue and samples out to people?
Yeah, well, first let me say I would prefer not to characterize the other side the way Mr. Hodge does. Of course, he's entitled to his opinion. Well, I just want to stick to the neuropathology here, as I know this gets very contentious. But basically, what was done is, as I understand it, the brain was extensively sampled, which means that, you know, parts of the brain are taken as representative of the brain as a whole. That's what's done in every single case. And those samples were immunostained. I don't know, you probably talk about this in passing in some of your podcasts, yep. But they're immunostained for tau protein. At a level that goes well beyond diagnostic approach to just about any other disease process. I mean, it is already really what could be aptly characterized as a fishing expedition for tau. And so that was done, and it was done in different laboratories. And different laboratories means that they have, you know, each laboratory differs. They have different reagents, they have different protocols, they have different companies that they work with, different machines. And so all of these different laboratories did the same workup for tau protein by their own laboratory methodologies in these representative areas, and found a normal brain in this case. So it's not, so this is not a complicated case. You know, Pete, I'm sure you in the forensic pathology world, you deal, unfortunately, with suicide victims on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And you look at many of these brains of a relatively young man, and it's very sad, and it's very difficult for the family. But the brain is normal. The brain is structurally normal.
That's right.
The problem is in the function. And this is just like any of those other cases. So this brain was, as I understand it, evaluated very extensively. And it was a normal brain, which is not surprising in the least, based on the history.
Now you said two things really interesting, Rudy. I want to just go back over them because I think they're really important. You know, you said, you know, when you are talking about other labs looking at this stuff, five different labs are going to do these things for research. I mean, you call these a fishing expedition for tau, and that means that people are really looking for this. I mean, it is being searched for, and I'll tell you from my experience, way above and beyond what we do for diagnostic pathology in a routine kind of service. So there's a really good look, a lot of samples, a lot of slides, a lot of staining through multiple approaches. So it wasn't just one standard methodology in multiple different labs. It was multiple different labs coming at the problem from multiple different approaches. So there were a multitude of ways that this was looked at extensively.
Can I add something to that I'd like both of you to weigh in on? And Rudy, thank you at the very beginning. That's why I've used great minds like you and Dr. Cummings, because you always temper my passion for when I read this stuff and I'm looking at it going, hey, listen, this is doing it on purpose. Okay, I like your scientific approach, brother. And that's what he's, listen, we got to have these dialogues. We got to have great minds all weighing in on this so we can actually find the truth. But getting back on point, what I wanted to ask, in all of the, so you two aren't the only ones I talked to about writing this book. Okay, I sat and met with Lily Hazarati. I've gone to a bunch of other neuropathologists individually, neurologists, and sat down with them to grill them about this CTE thing.
Yeah.
There was a couple things that came up that were interesting to me. I don't know how common this is, but I heard this two different times from two different separate neuropathologists. They said, now listen, here's a big problem we have. Boston University gives you the instructions on how to go about looking for it. But when they get it, they do a completely different procedure. I was like, what? They go, they don't follow their own procedures. They tell you what to do, and they make it very limited. And then they, to your point, your fishing expedition is actually a really good way to put it. He goes, the way they, my name more specific, they say, they tell you to cut these tiny little samples of tissue. But then they cut these like quarter size samples of tissues, like five times bigger. They go about different areas of the brain than they tell you to do. I'm like, that's where I get corrupt. That's where I call it. I get abusive. That's where I get angry that nobody unfortunately, people just don't know these facts. They're not going to go spend the time doing it, but they need to know these facts. So that to me is not, that's not a part of what you do in science.
And I think that Rudy brings me to the next question I want to ask you. So you have, you know, we're talking five labs here, six if you count Lil's. And then we have a case we talked about in the book from Ohio State, and another case we talked about that was out in Los Angeles where two other neuropathologists looked at two different cases, didn't find it.
Right.
So we're talking about, what, 7-8 labs who have not been able to replicate this. It gets to the BU CTE Center, and we have CTE. How is this happening? What do you think is sort of a process? Is it a artifactual thing? Is it a methodology thing? Do you have any thoughts on it with your experience?
Well, again, I have to say, I don't know what's going on in these other labs or what cases in Los Angeles and so forth we're talking about. I think you have to look very specifically at what's going on in one lab versus the other. But what we can say objectively is that there is tau immunostains being done at a enormous level in terms of the extent, and there's an additional what is really a research procedure that's done that Boston University does that they display it in their papers, which is a research technique that uses what's called a sledge microtome. It's basically a meat slicer. And it's basically a way of looking at large sections of brain, very thick sections of brain. It's a way of looking at quite a lot of real estate, much more, quote unquote, real estate in the brain, much more so than you would look by normal methodology. And that's fine. They can do that. They're certainly entitled to do that as a research technique. You know, the problem is that it's not used anywhere in the world of diagnostic pathology. So if you can do that, but it's really not validated for diagnostic use because you have a problem with sensitivity at that point. Mm-hmm. You're looking at a huge amount of brain, and you'll detect small amounts of tau in just about anybody with that technique, and in whatever distribution. And if you find that, and then you conclude that becomes a progressive neurodegenerative disease, I mean, that's just off the charts, outlandish. So
Hey, Rudy,
what's that?
I said, now you know where I got the word corrupt.
Well,
I'm sorry. It's just corrupt.
Well, I know that's me saying it.
That's not Rudy. Rudy's not saying that. But, he slaps me when I say that.
But they're entitled to have their what they're doing and come to whatever conclusions. It's just I'm just saying, objectively speaking, they're looking at quite a lot of real estate, and if you're going to draw these conclusions, you really need to do this exact same thing with the exact same age groups,
right,
to the exact same extent, and even then, if you find something, that still doesn't answer the question of whether that causes any problems. So it, you know, it's a very, very sensitive way of looking. So, you know, anytime, you know, mathematically speaking, anytime you maximize the sensitivity of a test, the specificity of that test goes down essentially in equal measure. So you could find something, but then you don't know what it means,
right,
basically.
When that, you know, that's, that brings me to another point, as I watched, I think it was up in Canada, the reporter talk about this, and McKee found it in this, the frontal lobe in an area of, like, because I had talked to a lot of neuropathologists that, you know, looked at this brain extensively. And he says, well, she found it in the frontal lobe, and it was responsible for decision-making and choices. Okay, so I was like, really? Decision-making and choices? So, exactly. Then this is where the media is just – so he commits suicide, so now they have just said they found CT where it's in the frontal lobe, and it makes your choices and decisions, and therefore that's why he committed suicide.
Yeah. And it was stage two.
Stage two. So why don't you just – I mean, people need to know what the frontal lobe is really responsible for, and then go to back to your point, which everybody I've talked to on this planet, Rudy, because you're not the only one, they keep saying, you know what, Merrill Tau, this – CT thing is a pattern. We don't know what it is. We don't know what causes it. We don't know what it causes. We don't know if it's serious. We don't we don't know. It's like I remember I remember one lady said, she goes, "Mary, you got a freckle on your forearm." All right. That's a disease.
Right.
That's a disease. It's a skin disease. I mean, it's a freckle.
Right.
Does that mean you're going to get skin cancer?
Yeah.
How long have you had that?
Yeah.
I mean, we look at that.
Right.
We don't know what that means. That's basically where we are with this thing.
Yeah.
And then when
that's an appropriate analogy.
Yeah, and I was like, wow. I mean, and for a reporter to say something like that. Now, if somebody who's not going to do their work, or there's a mom or a dad sitting there watching TV, and they're like, and their son or daughter wants to start playing hockey. No, you're not. You know, no, you're not. It's just like.
Right.
And it is just so, I mean, the incompetency is just mind-boggling of what is said in the media, but largely due to this, I got to say it again, just the corruptness of the processing of the science work. You know, I mean, your voice and Dr. Cummings' voice, you should be right next to Boston University, because that's what science is about. It's about having a bunch of different eyes and great minds looking at things and trying to collaborate to figure things out. Not like what's happening where you're hearing one voice out of Boston University. But go back to the frontal lobe. I kind of got off the idea. I wanted you to talk about that frontal lobe, and when a reporter says something like that, you know, it gives you the indicator that, oh, well, yep, they found CTE there. That's why he committed suicide, because it's in the frontal lobe. Because explain the difference between physical and emotional,
too. And talk about how you think, what stage two and how it plays a role in that. What that may mean. We'd love to hear your thoughts on that, Rudy, too.
Well, there's a lot there, so you're going to...
I know.
We'll stop talking for a minute.
You might have to direct me if I get off on a tangent, but it's really difficult to put into words how ridiculous all that is. So to say that, okay, there's a little spot in the frontal lobe. Frontal lobe has all these functions, and therefore those functions weren't working properly, and therefore what? Somebody made a decision to do something, that tragic like this? I mean, that's prehistoric level of scientific reasoning. It is just off the charts ridiculous. But the frontal lobe has many functions. I mean, it has functions in personality. It has functions in language. The posterior parts have function actually in motor control and movement and so forth. So a number of functions. But the frontal lobe is the largest lobe of all the lobes in the brain. And people have surgery on their frontal lobes on a regular basis, and they can have large portions of their frontal lobes taken out, and people can be functional afterwards, and we're not talking about their emotions and so forth many times. But what we have here is again an immuno stain. It's probably people don't understand what immunostains are really, but basically it's technicians adding substances and reagents to tissues and making them turn color. It's not something that you can see without that procedure. So if you look at the brain without the immunostain, it is completely, utterly normal. Then the technician adds reagents to that sample, and you see some brown staining, and then you draw conclusions based on that. And in this particular case, there's brown staining that is off in the corner of the frontal lobe somewhere. You could, my guess is, it's part of the frontal lobe that you could actually take out, and the person would not know the difference. But it's really connecting a lot of dots that are not connected anywhere. And so using that, I have to say, as the basis, and again, you have to have some respect for the affected family members here. But it's
very true.
It's obviously very tragic. But I think there's the other side of the coin is, infecting the psyche of large numbers of athletes with the idea that there's this process that leads to suicidal ideation, for which there is zero evidence. In fact, evidence to the contrary, I think is dangerous. I think it's frankly dangerous. So I think we have to be careful about that.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you.
Yeah, that's really well said. And I hope people really listen to that. Just to. That couldn't have been said more brilliantly, and people replay it and listen to it over and over, because not one time will it all sink in, because there was a lot there. But Rudy, that was just awesome. But go ahead, Pete.
No, I mean, I just blew my mind a little bit, Rudy. You with tau, and generally speaking, in tau and other neurodegenerative diseases where we see it, these tauopathies, we still don't know in those really well described diseases what tau is doing to produce any symptom. We have no idea,
right? That's
right.
You're right. That's correct. That is correct.
And to think that you have a stage one, which I think is essentially normal brain, and I think you could probably twist my arm to say that stage two is probably normal brain, normal right. aging. To think that,
yeah.
that, and you look at some of the age-related tauopathies where people don't have any symptoms. So how can it doesn't logically fit into my simple brain as to how we can say a single or two or three microscopic foci of this protein can be driving symptoms if we can't look at huge amounts of this protein in people's brains and can't right. find symptoms. What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, we can't. And so if there's any adult people listening to this podcast, every single one of them have this tau in their brain. It's just a matter of where and in what distribution. And it accumulates with age, and accumulates with in everyone with age. Everyone with a capital E has phosphorylated tau accumulating to various extents in their brain. The older you get, the more you accumulate, and some people have less, some people have more. But if everyone lives long enough, they're going to have phosphorylated tau in their brain. So and the autopsy analyses that are done are a very, very superficial indicator of the biology of what's going on with tau. Tau protein is a normal protein. It has normal functions. It's required. In fact, phosphorylation of tau that you talk about, that's a normal cellular process. What we're talking about are accumulations of tau that accumulate to the extent that you can throw an antibody on it and somehow identify it. And even then, you're looking at one antibody, directed to one part of the molecule. And those antibodies can even vary, and then those antibodies have to have a certain titer that you use, and then you have to use antigen retrieval that makes things different. And some of these immunostaining companies have actually proprietary reagents that you don't even know what they're using. So it's a very empirical exercise. The phosphorylated tau by itself has really no clinical meaning. Presence or absence of tau means nothing. The best you can say is that if you have a well characterized neurological disease, and you look at the brain and you find not just large accumulations of tau, but actually drop out of neurons and in certain distributions, then you can put it together and come up with a neurodegenerative disease.
Right.
But what we're talking about is basically any level of tau, any microscopic level of tau in the brain in a certain location is enough to qualify for a neurodegenerative disease. And I'm sorry, I just don't accept that.
No, I agree.
And so if that makes me a denier, then I'll deny that 6 days a week and twice on Sunday, because that's utter nonsense. So that's kind of what's going on. We're drawing way, 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 way too many conclusions from some immunostaining and autopsy brains.
And, I heard you talk about this a month or so ago, and you made a really important point. It was very, very subtle, but it really made an impression on me, and I think it's something people should think about. When you talk about the difference between researchers and diagnosticians, or practitioners.
Yeah.
And the way I've always kind of viewed it is you have researchers, and we can
right.
say the BUCT Center is a research lab. It's not a clinical lab. And
right.
when the idea is that research is brought to the floor of a hospital or to the pathology lab where we're going to make diagnoses and practice, that research is passed through the filter of our grades and levels of scientific evidence, so we can make evidence-based decisions into the clinical world. And
yeah.
I think that process here is completely skipped, where we're taking research directly from research, not putting it through the filter of evidence-based medicine grading, and using it as
yeah.
a therapeutic or intervention or policy decisions. And you touch on that for me if you got some thoughts on it.
Well, and I don't. Again, I'm not privy to what actually is going on. But the point of and the point about evidence-based medicine. One thing you could say is that we're talking about anecdotal cases and small case series, which by themselves have no scientific meaning at all. So we're not. This is really not an evidence-based. The CTE story has not really progressed yet to the point of being assessed by evidence-based medicine. But clinical laboratories where you'd make diagnostic interpretations on living patients, of course, have a lot of quality assurance in place, a lot of quality control. You know, if you, the antibodies that you use have been you know, validated. You have each case has a positive control. Each case has a negative control. A certain percentage of cases are reviewed by other people, you know, sort of audited for diagnostic accuracy. And the other, and so there's that piece in the clinical side. On the research side, you basically don't have that level of rigor in terms of diagnostic, in terms of the diagnostic approach to whatever disease process you're talking about. So you can look at a small number of cases, you look at stains, you take a picture and you publish a paper on it, and it's all good. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just that's quite a bit different than the level of rigor in diagnostic pathology. And really, I think one of the reasons why I get in trouble in this whole area is because I've actually always worked in surgical neuropathology my entire career. So I, you know, make diagnosis on living patients, and right. So I'm really sensitive to what has diagnostic meaning and what doesn't.
Yep.
In the autopsy situation, there's really no consequence for a diagnostic error, right. You know, because unfortunately the patient's dead. So you can say what you want, and that becomes the conclusion. You can't do that in clinical medicine, patient care. I mean, if you're wrong, it'll come back to you.
Yeah.
So anyway, you're very sensitive to what's diagnostically meaningful in the clinical laboratory patient care setting, and it's not the case in the autopsy setting, and it's not the case in the research setting.
Right. And so
I don't know if that's
great.
Nuanced or what.
I what you say is so reasonable, and I think that when you're, you know, and this is not what you're saying is, you know, for lack of a better word, an opinion, but it's based on practice, and it's not your opinion of the flow of methodology. You're just following the steps of science. So when you come out and say things like exactly what you just said, you know, this is research, you know, all the things you said about the differences in clinical diagnosis, and talking about it's a fact, it's a scientific fact that these are case series. It's the lowest form, than a case report, the lowest form of scientific evidence. And if you say that kind of stuff, it's fact. I mean, that's not an opinion. That is, there are charts and graphs. It's been studied. There are criteria to follow for each of those. How come when you and I come out and say that, we're skeptics, we're deniers, when we're actually saying we got to follow the scientific method? I mean, how does that happen in this world?
I mean, I think that's a question for a sociologist or somebody. That's outside my pay grade. As a citizen, I not as an expert in anything, just as a citizen, I worry that antipathy for sports or sports organizations might be driving some of the thoughts of the science, and so it's easy. I think people get a little conspiratorial. You know, if you have this exotic new disease, and then you have the overlay of a club of billionaires,
Hollywood movie,
Hollywood movie, and it's hard. You know, I think people can't help but get behind the grassy knoll there and think that people are hiding things, and people are not being upfront with the data. They've hidden data and covering things up and all that. But the real science, the discipline-minded, you know, medical scientist has to ignore all that. That has nothing. All that stuff is a sideshow. It has nothing to do with head trauma. It has nothing to do with long-term consequences of head trauma. It has nothing to do with tau pathophysiology. That's just a sideshow. So again, I just say, as a citizen, I worry that some of these extracurricular, ex-cathedral issues are coming in and influencing how things get reported, and you know how. And to some extent, I worry that it's influencing the direction of the science and the research.
Well, you know, you just made a question kind of pop into my head when you were talking there. One of the things that people discuss a lot is this direct link between head trauma and the development of neurodegenerative diseases across the board. What are your thoughts on that?
that's a work in progress. I mean, there's the and again, this gets me, I suppose, into some trouble, but the idea that head trauma causes neurodegenerative diseases has not been shown scientifically.
Right.
The best you can do is look at large-scale epidemiology, and you can find a relative risk of head trauma that has a very modest, very minor relative risk for Alzheimer's disease. That's in the literature, and in none of those series is there actual pathological confirmation.
Yeah.
And a lot of this, and in fact, much of this concept that head trauma leads to neurodegenerative diseases comes from early 20th century boxers who are lost to history now. And in fact, if you look closely at those cases, the data that suggests that, you know, head trauma with a period of latency, with a period of progressive disease like Alzheimer's disease, that again is, it's just not there. It's just not in the case series. And there are a lot of misdiagnoses, and there's a lot of incomplete histories. And so when you really drill down into the head trauma issue with respect to neurodegenerative diseases, the idea that head trauma somehow initiates this process that leads to Alzheimer's-like disease, in my opinion, the evidence is not there. It's just not there. But that idea, that concept is out there. And it's sort of widely accepted that repetitive head trauma, et cetera, leads to progressive neurodegenerative disease. But that's a theory, and the actual empirical human evidence to back that up is very, very sparse and very, very difficult to find when you really drill down into it.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Rudy, I can't even tell you. I can sit here and listen over and over and over to you. I've done it before, time and time again. Those that are listening now, I just encourage you to rewind it and listen to it again, because it is a lot, but it is extremely important that you understand, you know, just really what's gone on here. And I think in the simplest terms, I've heard it over and over again too, Rudy, not from you and not just from Peter, Dr. Cummings, but I can't tell you how many times I've listened to people say, listen, Boston University has done the lowest grade of science you could possibly do and keep your integrity intact. Well, in this particular research, in fact, and that, like you both said, is 100% fact. The science papers scream it and tell you that. The problem with, to answer both your questions about how does this happen, the media does not do that. The media is not going to go read the science papers. They don't want to know. Listen, a majority do not want to know the truth, okay? Even when you have time to explain it to them, they don't want to listen. They've already made up their mind by the lowest grade of science you could possibly do that is still missing a variety of steps. And, I mean, I can't even tell you how much research still needs to be done. I try to tell people this all the time. Alzheimer's, they've done what? Been studying over well over 100 years, hundreds and hundreds of doctors, hundreds and hundreds of papers, thousands and thousands of brains, and they still don't know what caused it. So you're going to tell me that at this point we've done a pinprick of research on CT and you know what causes it and you know what it causes? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Laughable.
Right. But Merrill, there's a very incendiary things you're saying there, so I cannot sign on to all that. But
that's okay, Rudy. That's why I wrote the book.
I warned you. He's fired up today, Rudy.
But I think it is important. It's important to ask questions. I mean, science is about asking questions, and that's, I think, all. At the end of the day, that's all we're doing is asking questions rather than, so, you know, science is really a mode of inquiry. It's not a source of authority. So asking questions is a good thing, but you know, the way you characterize it, I'll leave that to the running back who has to.
That's why I'm not a scientist. That's why I'm not a professor. That's why I call you guys for that stuff.
Yeah.
And then I do it this way, Rudy. Listen, your insight, absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for joining the Merrill Hodge Find a Way podcast.
All right, thank you, Rudy. All right,
thanks for having me.
Wow. What Rudy said there, and I mean, there's just so many amazing nuggets that you can learn from. You know, if you know nothing about science, if you know nothing about the process, if you listen to him and you understand all of the details, that's what I love about pros in whatever profession it is, and learn all the detailed things that you just wouldn't know. you know, but he referred to himself as like a citizen, how concerned he is by the message that's getting out there. Here's a guy who understands the processes of science. And when you look at what happened with Todd Ewan, if you just look at it simply, there's a couple things he hit that really resonated with me, and you said them as well. You got six highly trained neuropathologists individually looked at these, looked at Todd Ewan's brain in the, did their own samples, did their own staining, did their own studies. All of them. None of them found CT. See, they saw it as one of the cleaner brains based on his history and his age. It goes to Ann McKee, and she just mysteriously finds it. And she finds it in the frontal lobe. And what she does is sends out her scans to somebody in Jacksonville, goes, hey, don't, isn't this what you see? Didn't let them do their own scans. Didn't let them do their own testing. Like that right there, that's why I use, I don't know, Rudy, you know, it's his profession. But if you... The more you talk about it, it is corrupt. It is wrong. It is wrong in every phase of science of what's being done. And then the messaging we're hearing from the media to have a reporter stand there and go, oh, well, they had CT in the frontal lobe and you're responsible for choices and decision. He just got done talking about you can remove the frontal pieces of the frontal lobe and you can not affect your emotions and decisions. To have a little tiny speck of they don't even know what it is and refer that in the media in the manner in which they do. Just is, it tells you this, the incompetence from the media perspective, the abuse of science, the misuse of science. And that's why, you know, the book became so passionate for me, is once you started knowing all these things and seeing all these things, and that's why the book may be more relevant now than ever. We wrote this, what, a little over 2 months ago? We told you it was going to happen before it happened. So right there, it's evidence. I could already tell by what had happened in my journey that the corruptness and the things that were going on, that was going to happen. That was going to happen. It was going to go to BU, and they were going to find CT, regardless of what six others said. And then you make the point, if you're looking, let's say, all of them together in a room, and it's 6-2, what do you guys say? The consensus. Doesn't mean everybody has to agree, but the consensus is no CTE. So it's unfortunate the narrative has been like this, but this is the one that now Boston University is going to have to answer to in a lot of ways, and we're not going to get off this one because, and the book is evidence that this was predicted way before it even happened. You want to wrap up with anything?
Yeah, Doc? Just a couple quick thoughts. You know, that was powerful stuff from Rudy, and every time I hear him, I learn about 10 things. He's a fantastic mind in this, and one thing he said that really struck me was infecting the psyche of athletes with this,
yeah,
at all levels.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
We have kids, high school kids, terrified after a concussion.
Parents.
They have CT. Parents terrified they have they're going to get CT after concussion, and there's no scientific evidence of that. The other thing that here that with the Todd Ewan story that kind of blows my mind a little bit is the major story here that's being missed by the media is this diagnostic discrepancy. That's a big story. Now, if this was an FDA thing or if this was another type of clinical, if there was a clinical lab diagnosing cancer or some other disease and there was this much discrepancy in diagnostic findings, it'd be shut down. So if we have if we have five neuropathologists, six if you count Lil, plus the two cases, one from Ohio State, one from LA, there's eight high-profile CTE cases, or three cases, but eight neuropathologists individually looking at them. Different labs using probably eight different methodologies, still can't find it. It gets to BU, it's CTE, right? That is a major problem, and that should terrify people. If we're having that much of a discrepancy in a diagnosis, if it's that prevalent and everybody has it, and it's this much of a problem in our community, and now it's become a much wider community-based health issue, then the community pathologist should be able to find it.
Right.
And they can't.
Or at least four of eight find it.
Do you think
at least three of five find it?
One out of them would find it.
One of eight.
And why is the media then immediately turn and say, oh, well, those other eight neuropathologists are wrong? It's this one. It's BU. And because BU says it is,
yes,
it's
you're right.
And
Pete,
that
you're
you
right.
have been brainwashed.
Yes.
That's the point of the book. Thank you very much for proving it. Somebody with some integrity out there, an investigative journalist, has got to get into this story and find out what the hell is going on, because BU would find CTE in a rock.
Amen, my brother. Okay, you couldn't have wrapped it up any better. This is one, I think, one of the most powerful podcasts. We'll probably come back to it many times because this case is not going to go away, because eventually the truth will rise and people who have been lying are going to get exposed and been doing things wrong and in a corrupt manner are going to get exposed. So we appreciate Rudy Castellani for joining us on the Merrill Hodge Find a Way podcast.